This is David Soselsky, Southern Oral History Program, University of North Carolina. This is another in the series, Listening for a Change. It's December 6, 1998. I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I'm interviewing Mr. Otis Hardy.
Okay, you want to introduce yourself on tape?
Yes, my name is Otis. First name O-T-I-S, last name is Hardy. H-A-R-D-Y.
And Otis, when were you born?
I was born December 12, 1945.
And where were you born?
I was born in a place called McCormick, South Carolina.
Uh-huh.
I was raised up there until I was at the age of 14 years old. I'd be 13, 14 years old.
Uh-huh. So, where's McCormick? Is it near someplace I know?
Near Greenwood, South Carolina, near Georgia. A place called Augusta, Georgia, you know,
uh-huh.
In that area there. It's a little rural area that my family, we migrated from McCormick to New Jersey,
uh-huh.
At a very early age. A place called East Orange, New Jersey.
But you said you were in South Carolina until you were about 13?
Yes, sir.
Your people were farming people or factory people?
No, sir, they wasn't farming people. My father at the time, he was a concrete person.
Uh-huh.
I never really got the chance to know my father. He was into other things, you know, at that time.
Uh-huh.
My biological father, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
My mother raised us. I have five brothers, and I have three sisters.
Uh-huh.
My mother used a razor during that time. And my father was really never around too much that much at the time.
Uh-huh. And then when you were 13, you moved to
East Orange, Jersey. New Jersey. Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. Before we go on, let's just a couple other kind of basics. What was your mama's name?
My mother's name was Edith,
Edith Hardy. Okay, and right now, where do you live?
I'm at Raleigh here, Wake Correctional Center.
Uh-huh. And right now you work at.
I work at the Governor's Mansion.
And that's, what do you do there?
I am I'm a pastry chef or a baker, whatever you want to call it.
Of great renown.
Great renown, yes, sir.
That's right. Okay, now that we got that established,
yes,
how do you think, to convey your life properly, where do you think we should start?
Well, you know, the beginning of my life, really, the most interesting part, fulfilling part to me was when I migrated to East Orange, New Jersey.
Why'd your family move?
Well, my family moved because, you know, like during the South during that time, it was prosperity in the North, you know.
Right.
And most black people during that time, they did migrate from the South into the North.
Uh-huh.
Opportunities was available. For instance, my mother, she worked with a sleep-in maid.
Uh-huh.
And she worked from wealthy people up in South Orange, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, a lot of the northern people were to, what they would do, they would just put ads in the paper for maids and that sort of a thing, you know, from the South, because people in the South was more of a working class person, you know,
mm-hmm.
than the people in the North. So that's how my mother actually got up to New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And we all came with it, except me. I was the only one that didn't come. I stayed behind for a period of time, and later on I lived with my grandmother, and my grandmother was the one that took care of me for a few months, and then I came up to New Jersey. But my life was interesting. It started out in New Jersey. I went to East Orange High School. I was projected as a football player to play professional football. I was good at sports, but what happened was that I was introduced to Islam. At a very early age, when I was ninth or tenth grade in high school, and becoming involved with Islam, I was into the black ideal of Afros, a black man in this country, and et cetera, et cetera. I believed that the white man at that time was an oppressor, so to speak, was a slave master, and this is what I was taught at a very early age. And my spiritual father, my father became a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
My biological father had passed away by that time. And I was taken in with a Muslim family.
Mm-hmm.
and I spent all my life with them. So
you had grown up in a Baptist household.
Well, I had never been to church.
Uh-huh.
You know, I had never really got involved with too much church.
Right.
Although that was all around me.
Sure.
I didn't know understand anything about Baptist or Holiness or
right.
Presbyterian. I've heard the name Jesus many times, and
right.
and as a child, you know, you hear your mother talk about Jesus and that sort of thing. So I was never involved with Christianity, although I was surrounded by it, you know.
Uh-huh. And so when did you convert to Islam?
I converted to Islam in early age of 1962.
Uh-huh. So you were about 17, 18 years old?
Yes, sir. About 17, 18 at the time. I was still in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the time of Malcolm X was the biggest thing going in. I was actually committed to Islam in 61, 62.
Uh-huh. And you admired Malcolm?
Yes, sir. I admired Malcolm X, but I admired Elijah Muhammad. He was our leader.
Uh-huh.
And out of Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And being raised up in Islam for young black men, it's somewhat, it's a stigma today that all you have to do is just worship Allah and believe in Islam and Farrakhan, Elijah Muhammad, and all of your popular leaders today. And it, you know, it's basically an excuse to divert your hatred and anger to point it towards another. But during my time, it was Elijah Muhammad. And I was taught that in order for me to become a Muslim, or anybody else at that time, what you had to do was you had to write a letter of intent. Every black man had to write a letter. And the letter was a copyrighted letter to Elijah Muhammad, stating the fact that you believed in what we call Wallace D. Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
He was a prophet from the East that came in the persons of God, as they said it. And write a letter to him and expressing the fact that you did believe in that, and you would get your ex. So that's what I did, you know, at an early age, you know, very early age. And I became a very moving person in Islam. I married into one of the biggest families in Islam.
That family was?
Minister James Shabazz.
Mm-hmm.
And I married into his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And his daughter was Deborah Shabazz. And I married it. I had three children, and I raised up. I became a very, very popular person in Islam. You know,
mm-hmm.
I was a dedicated worker. I was a dedicated believer, and I was dedicated in every aspect of life as I possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
But that changed a lot in my life. Being married and a wonderful family. I had a wonderful wife and wonderful children, and a wonderful atmosphere that I was raised up in. Years later, my father-in-law passed away. When my father-in-law passed away from an assassination.
Mm. Now he was like the leader of he
was the leader of
in Jersey, wasn't he?
Yes, sir. He was the leader of Northern New Jersey.
And he was assassinated.
He was assassinated, yes, sir. 1975, he was assassinated. And he was a fine man. He was a wonderful man. Good family man. And he was assassinated. Many believe that Farrakhan was responsible for his death, as well as many people believe that Malcolm X was assassinated because of Farrakhan. But on the day that he was assassinated, I was with Minister Farrakhan. So his actual involvement, I don't know the extent of it, but I was with him that particular day.
But it was seen as kind of an internecine war within the Islamic leadership.
Yes, sir.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So, but things change. My family and I moved from New Jersey to Greensboro, North Carolina. From New Jersey to Greensboro.
You wanted to put some distance between yourself and all that, or why'd you move back to?
Well, it was a lot of difficulties and problems during that time. Being that my father-in-law had was assassinated and passed on, and it was somewhat of a power struggle going on.
You were caught up in that in some way?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
So my family moved on. We moved down to Greensboro.
Uh-huh.
But we could eliminate a lot of difficulties and problems.
Uh-huh.
So we got to Greensboro, and and we were blessed to be able to just carry on. Mm-hmm. But most of my family now lives in Greensboro, on my wife's side. Mm-hmm. So that's how we really got to Greensboro.
Before you left, were you supporting yourself within the temple? Yes, sir.
I worked for the temple. Mm-hmm. That was my job. I was like a coordinator, a business manager, a consultant, so to speak, of all the businesses in the northern New Jersey area. My responsibility was to set up new businesses, to own, to operate them, mm-hmm. and to make sure of their welfare, so to speak, and employees. That was my business, you know, mm-hmm. basically. And I did that for a number of years, and we were very successful.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I know you heard of the bean pie and
and
that sort of thing. So
that's you.
Yes, sir. I was part of that.
How about that?
I was blessed. As a distributing part of it, uh-huh. not making them, but I distributed them uh-huh. place to place.
And during the when did you leave the business side behind as well when you came to Greensboro?
Yes, sir. Everything was left.
Just a whole new life.
We started from scratch. We came here, and matter of fact, my family went into the real estate business. Uh-huh. You know, started selling real estate. And became very successful at that. Most of my family is involved in real estate as of now in Greensboro.
Well, just before we move on with the story,
yes, sir.
It's a little unfair to ask someone to evaluate themselves.
Yes, sir.
But if you could look back at the man you were then,
right,
say in 1972 or 3,
right,
how would you have described yourself? At every level, but emotionally and personally,
right,
what kind of presence you were,
right? Well, in the early 70s, I was a young black man that was had a lot of zealous. I was a lot of zeal by myself. Uh-huh. I was a black man that had a challenge, always met a challenge, regardless to what it was. And I had a lot of enthusiasm. I didn't take defeat for as an accepted part of my life. Uh-huh. When it was dealing with the temple-wise and dealing with the business, the aspect of it. But one thing that was in me that I can look back now and see, I was a person that had a lot of hatred in my heart. And I was a person that had a lot of disrespect for people. Mm. And during that time, that was accepted in Islam.
Right.
But it wasn't accepted in the open market.
Right.
I could deal with all kinds of people, mm-hmm. but I couldn't deal with nobody outside of Islam. Because I didn't like anybody outside of Islam. Everything was confined within the religion. And that's what many of black men do today. But to look at myself during that time and now is a great difference. I'm completely a new person. But I don't just say I would knock Islam. I'm not knocking Islam. Because
you called it a loving. You said you had a very loving family life as part of it.
Yes, my family. Uh-huh. You know, it's a very closeness that in that aspect. It teaches you to love your family, love yourself, but it doesn't teach you to go beyond that. As well in Christianity, it says that, you know, do good to all men, but especially of those of the household of faith. But you know, in Islam, it really just, you know, do unto your brother as you would have someone do unto you.
But before we kind of go to,
yeah,
to and talk about the changes that come later,
right,
and the new, and as you said, the new person you've become,
right, right.
I guess I want to understand looking even further back. Where did that hatred come from, and what was it, the Reverend? May not know that that this tape machine can record every single piece of that car washing that he's doing over there, but I think we're still getting mostly you.
Right, right.
But what that you know, things must have happened to you or in your life that right. made you seek out.
Right. Well, you know, being raised in the South as a young boy, you know, like you were age of 10, 12, 13 years old. And you get a chance to really see a lot of things that goes on in society. You get a chance to see your mother, or your father, or your neighbors, or your friends, part of your family. You get a chance to see them being abused, so to speak. Worked hard and just talked about it and just treated unfairly. For instance, what sticks in my mind was when I was, I guess, 10 years old or something, and I had a young white kid. I was walking to the store one day, and I had a little young white kid come up and kick me, you know, mm-hmm. and run back in. See, during that time, I'm 10 years old.
Right.
And I chased this little guy, and I went home, and I couldn't catch him, but I went home and told my mother that what had happened, and she whooped me. You know, because she told me I should have never did that. She said that I was wrong. You know, and I couldn't understand it as a child. And during that time, whenever we went to the movies, we would always have to sit upstairs. We couldn't sit. When we always had to drink water from a fountain, we had to drink it from a dirty-looking fountain.
Right,
The color. It was very bad. I mean, when you went to a school, we had to go to a school with all your kind. When you go to a restaurant, I had to go in the back. And not so for me, but I used to see this.
Yeah.
And I used to see this as a child. And
you saw your mother mistreated, so.
And mother being mistreated, worked hard and just talked about it any kind of way. And I remember an insurance man came to my house once. I guess I was 8, 9 years old or something, whatever. And this insurance man was collecting money. And he was standing in the kitchen talking to my mother. And while my mother was washing clothes, he spit in the sink, you know. And he washed it down with water. And, you know, I'm a little kid.
Right.
And these little things, it has an effect on your life. Mm-hmm. You know, kids don't forget things like that. Mm-hmm. They don't forget it. They're not going to forget if you treat them unfairly. Mm-hmm. I'm quite sure there's things in all of our life that, as a child, that we will never forget. Some positive, some negative. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some things that we hold on to. And there's some things that we don't forget. But there's a point in our life, in order for us to move on in our life and be productive, we're going to have to forget them. But those things that when I came to the North, those things I remembered. And I reached out for something. Mm-hmm. And who accepted me was Muslims. Mm-hmm. Those are the people that I was attracted to because they would call me brother. Mm-hmm. And that is exactly what's going on today. Because they call you brother. They look good from the outside. They wear nice bow ties. They wear nice clothes. They're clean looking. They got nice haircuts, you know. That attracts.
Well, and they also just stand up to whites.
Sure.
In a way that if you've seen, I mean, in South Carolina, I mean, you know, I mean, I could see that.
Sure, it's a big difference.
And the brothers look good.
Okay, sure, they look good.
I mean, they stand up.
Yeah.
In your face.
That's right. Very positive.
And even as a, even as like a white man in the South.
Right.
You know, I noticed that the way the brothers look.
Right.
Is like directly at your in. You know.
That's right.
You know, I mean,
That's right.
I mean, you can talk to each other actually because.
That's right.
You're real direct.
That's right.
But
that's right.
They look at you the way, the quote unquote normal Southern. You know, black young man is not going to look at you.
That's right. And you know because of his type of attitude.
This is a man standing that you're
right.
looking at.
That's right.
You know that.
That's right. And this is what attracts a lot of people. And this is what attracted me at a young age. So I left home at a very young age as a child. You know, and now I was and a Muslim family gave me love and cared for me. And I lived with a couple of brothers, you know, earlier in my life, you know, and that's all I knew. Mm-hmm. And that's all I wanted. Mm-hmm. And I was accepted, I was loved, I was appreciated. Mm-hmm. And I could go someplace and the white man would respect me. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe because of fear or whatever, but he respected me.
What was the very first time that you saw you know, appeal to that you were introduced to Islam, that you said that these guys are, that's something interesting happening there. Do you remember the first time?
First time, yes, sir.
I'll bring those treats over while you talk, and I'll bring them over.
Yeah, the first time that this experience ever happened to me is that I was downtown.
In East Orange, or?
And I was downtown Newark.
Uh-huh.
And I saw these two young men. I guess I'm very, very young. I don't know how old I was at the time.
A young teenager?
Oh, I was very young, yes, young, very young. And I saw these two guys standing on the corner, these two black men, I mean, sharp and intelligent looking, I mean, with a bow tie, and I just said, wow. And I was just amazed,
uh-huh.
And it touched me. I said, I want that. I was attracted to that, you know? And we're attracted to many things. You see, a man can only be attracted to whatever's in him. He has to have some of that in him in order to be attracted to something, you know? And obviously that was in me, and I was attracted to it. And
milk,
that's...
You got milk in your coffee?
No, sir. That's exactly what I wanted.
Uh-huh.
My mind was set.
See that? Sure.
Sure. And that's what I took off. But I have always excelled in anything that I went into. I've always excelled in it. For some reason, I've always excelled in it. Because whatever I enjoyed doing, I did my best at it. You know, and that's what happened to me. I started selling, during that time it was selling what we call Muhammad Speak newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
I sold more papers than anybody. I was selling
door
like
door to door, or like on the street corner?
Door to door, street corners, everywhere. Mm-hmm. I was selling 2,500 papers a week.
Wow.
You know, and I was involved. I was involved with the business aspect. If they needed somebody to move a new product, I was the one. If they needed somebody to do this, I was the one. I was capable and comfortable of doing all, regardless to what it was. And I felt good at it. And I raised to a standard in Islam, even to this very day, that many people still speak of me because I did great works. But that's a big difference in my life now and then before. But that was a great time. There's many instances that I've seen. I've had an opportunity that I fellowship with Muhammad Ali, Joe Tex,
wow.
All of the great men of Islam. I've been a part of them in some way or another, because Newark, New Jersey was a great city. Newark, New Jersey was a city of prosperity. We did great things in Newark. And Islam is on the rise. And I think that the greatest thing today is that Christians really don't study Islam. They're not familiar with it. That's why a lot of us is losing our young people to Islam, because they're attracted to something that's positive. They're attracted to something that where men can stand up and be a man. Young men today do not want people in their lives that's going to be a wimp, that's not going to stand up to the oppressor. They want men that has backbone. They want to be associated with that, because everything that you see on TV today and the music, everything implicates the fact that, hey, the black man is the leader. Mm-hmm. The black man is powerful. Mm-hmm. And this is why they're attracted to Islam today. This is why people are attracted to Farrakhan.
Sure.
A lot of people don't even realize that, you know, in Islam, you got 100 names, what you call attributes. And you can't find Farrakhan in none of those names. It's not a Muslim name. Farrakhan obviously don't even know what that name means. But that's people follow things because of what they see. You know, if they dig deeper, they discover a great deal. So that's why a lot of black men today is moving on to Islam. And that's why I myself, as a young boy, very young boy, moved to that point in my life where I became a follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad during that time.
Well, why don't we pick up the story from here? Where is Otis Hardy taken next?
Well,
we moved to Greensboro, and we pick up the story from
there. Yeah, well, you know, when I came to Greensboro, everybody knew me in New Jersey. Everybody was familiar with me. I was very known, well known. Chicago, New Jersey, different places, New York. And when I came here, nobody knew me. So I could do some of the things that perhaps I've always wanted to do. And that was just hang out. And see, one thing about Islam, it's great for great wisdom, I mean for knowledge. You want knowledge, you want to know a lot of knowledge things, sure, Islam is great. But the Islam cleans up the outside. It's like baking a loaf of bread. There's baking a loaf of bread, you have to cook it on a, start out cooking the bread from the inside and then cook it from the inside out. If you cook bread from the outside in, that means the crust will look nice, but the inside will be mushy. So that's the same thing about way of life. See, the transformation has to take part from the inside and work itself out. So all my life, I was only working on the outward appearance. I was dealing with the works that I do. I was dealing with strictly my soul, not in my intellect, that would use that to get me over with. But when I came here, I discovered that I was empty on the outside, but I looked good from the outside. So I started being enticed and different things, and I started doing things, I started living with, and I got involved with criminal activities. I got involved with loose living, with women. And I discovered that in order for me to continue to live like that, the more and more I got deep into what I was into, I needed more money. And so my money, my resources had dwindled. So I had to rely on getting money any way I could get it. So I tried this way and that way and this way. And any kind of way I could get money, that's what I resorted to. I didn't have a conscience. Nothing happens. Whatever way I could get it, I got it. So I started, wherever I saw money, I would get it. And that's what I done. I was never hooked on drugs or nothing. I was hooked on something worse than drugs. And that was being something that I wasn't and trying to maintain an image that I really didn't even know where it was taking me. So I started robbing. I stole some money and it got good to me. And I stole some more money and it got better to me. And I ended up, I got caught. And when I got caught, believe it or not, this may sound real crazy, but I was kind of pleased that I did get caught. I was glad it was over with, because I was going deeper and deeper and deeper. Because the only thing I could lose from then on was my life. And I had three beautiful children, man. It's just, and I spent no time at home. I was always on the go, and I had a wonderful wife, and I just destroyed all that. And I got arrested in 1979, in June of 1979. And they charged me with 6 or 7 counts of armed robbery. And they ended up giving me, went to court, and they gave me 2 life sentences, basically. And I didn't understand what the judge was saying, but anyway, I went to prison, and before I went, they let me talk to my wife, and I told her, she was crying, and I told her that I'd be home in a few years, you know, it's all right. And I really confused myself that I was going to be home in a few years. Mm-hmm. And they sent me to Central Prison, and the first day I got to Central Prison, I saw a man get killed. And they served me a meatloaf dinner.
This was the first day.
First day, so I don't eat meatloaf no more. so, So anyway, the first day I saw a man get stabbed, get killed in there. A week later on a Sunday, I saw a man get stabbed in the kitchen and get killed. We had fried chicken. God, I hated to leave my fried chicken, you know. So one chain of events after another, I saw a man get robbed. I saw a man get raped. Within the course of a month, I've seen so many things in prison. And I say to myself, what in the world I got myself into? And I saw a young...
This was the old prison, right?
Old prison, old central prison.
Which was not a nice place.
No, sir.
I mean, I know none of them are nice, but that was a rough...
It looked rough, at least. Believe me, it was death.
It was
death in there.
Dripping with water all the time.
Dripping with water.
Cold. I visited somebody in there.
It's the atmosphere.
It looked like something out of the Dark Age, medieval history or something.
It was the very atmosphere... because death loomed in there. It was the devil's den. Anybody that felt comfortable in there was obviously got a problem.
It did something to the people that worked there, too.
Yes. Well, you know, Paul Harvey made a statement. Paul Harvey said, if you want to see the scum of the earth, he said, go by any prison doing shift change. So obviously, you know, people that...